thank you all very much for turning out here. I've got a contact list which I'll pass around at some point. So if you do want us, again, to get in touch with you, please do leave your details. There are some booklets here as well. But without further ado, we'll pass on to the main business of today, which is a talk by my colleague here, Steve Clayton, Lessons of the First World War, I think, which is an appropriate topic for today. Thank you very much, Steve.
Okay. Yeah, good afternoon, everybody. Yeah, Lessons of the First World War. I couldn't actually think of a title, and it's not a very good title. I apologise for that. It's Remembrance Sunday, and I'm basically going to talk about the First World War, but also I'm going to talk about the Second World War as well, because it really runs on to that. So how should I start, really? Well, in the last 100 years, there's been a proliferation of war in capitalism, and we've had two world wars and numerous civil wars and such like. And this is the period of the advanced industrial capitalism, you know, imperialism. What I'm going to actually talk about is wars are absolutely central to the operation of capitalism. I mean, this year is the centenary of the start of the First World War. And what the capitalist class has been doing recently is actually revising the historical accounts of the First World War. David Cameron has made a speech at the Imperial War Museum in 2012 where he announced that there was going to be commemorative events to mark the centenary of the First World War. I mean, the talk is a disgrace, actually. I'm not going to talk about that talk that he actually gave, because I've actually talked about that a couple of years ago for the party. But basically, Cameron was actually comparing commemorative events to mark the centenary of the First World War to the Diamond Jubilee and the London Olympics of 2012. I mean, all this was done to... for the British capitalist class is endeavouring to sort of bolster British nationalism and militarism. I mean, the celebrations and the normality of Poppy Day appeal and the Help for Heroes, they all combine to create a powerful consensus in the nation state with its strong links to the military. And it softens the working class up to accept military intervention, say, in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya and Syria. I will come back to David Cameron's speech, but I want to talk about somebody else as well. There's a gentleman called Gary Sheffield, who is a professor of war studies. I mean, he wrote in History Today in August this year that the Great War was a just war. And he says it's time to ditch the Blackadder view of history. And he says that Britain was right to fight Imperial Germany in 1914. To quote his article, he said, "Germany took full advantage to carry out a war of conquest and aggression. Britain's First World War was a war of national survival, a defensive conflict fought at a huge cost against an aggressive enemy bent on achieving hegemony in Europe." I mean, things like Blackadder goes forth and, oh, what a lovely war. I mean, the only way to deal with the senseless slaughter of all the human life in the First World War is through sort of macabre humour. But it actually hits a raw nerve for the capitalist class. And going back to David Cameron's speech in 2012, he actually said... for the working class in 1914, for many, going off to war was a rite of passage. Many of them were excited. They would eat better than they had when they were down the mines or in the textile mills. They would have access to better medical care. That's a disgraceful statement. And also, he points out that the First World War was good for advancing the emancipation of women by the execution of Edith Cavell. And he said that the death of the first black army officer was the beginnings of ethnic minorities getting recognition, respect and equality. And he also says, advances in medicine, advances in technology transformed the nature of war. Back to Gary Sheffield again. I mean, he's been trying to rehabilitate Douglas Haig, you know, Field Marshal Haig, and that's linked with some revisionism about the Battle of the Somme. Comrades and visitors will know about the Battle of the Somme, the first day of which, on the 1st of July 1916, saw 60,000 British soldiers killed or wounded. It's the bloodiest day in the history of the British Army. Across all the contending armies of the Somme, in the first 4 months of that battle, more than 1 million men were killed or wounded. And when the battle ended in November, the British line had moved forward 6 miles and was still 3 miles short of the first day's objective. Now, for Sheffield, rather than being the site of senseless slaughter on a vast scale, on balance, he says, the Somme did more damage to the Germans than to the Allies. And in spite of the heavy losses, the British Army emerged from the battle as a much improved, effective fighting force. I mean, that just demonstrates contempt for the lives and deaths of the working class men in the trenches in that battle. I mean, the fundamental principle of capitalism is competition. perpetual economic competition in capitalism creates the need for conflict. When economic rivalry becomes too intense, the next step is often military conflict. I mean, the Prussian military theorists of the early 1800s, Clausewitz, he said, war is a continuation of politics by other means. I mean, wars are caused by the competitive nature of capitalism. Wars are fought over sources of raw materials, rich mineral resources, investment outlets, vital trade routes over land, sea or air, markets and exploitable populations. Rosa Luxemburg wrote, "The accumulation of capital employs force as a permanent weapon." In wars, the working class, us, the people, are persuaded to identify with the capitalist cause in the mistaken belief that they are fighting for a higher national interest. Wars have the terrible effect of veiling the class struggle by developing a false sense of identity between exploiters and the exploited in each country. But the national interest was and always is the capitalist interest. Workers have nothing to gain from fighting the battles of a class whose interests are opposed to their own. I mean, profits and investments do not belong to the working class, so the interests of the capitalist and working class are diametrically opposed. So the working class have no interest in supporting war to protect profits, investments, the overseas territories of raw materials and strategic trade routes. So what we say in the Socialist Party, the protection of capitalism is not worth a million people's lives, or indeed one person's life. The working class have nothing to gain by victory, or nothing to lose by defeat. So victory and defeat leave the working class in the same position. They suffer all the horrors that go with the war, but they gain nothing from victory and lose nothing in defeat. The transfer of population, four times in 75 years, in Alsace and Lorraine, which is in France. It transferred from Germany to France four times in 75 years. I mean, it made no material change to the status of the condition of the working class in those regions. I mean, the rich iron deposits in Lorraine and the thriving textile factories in Alsace were owned all the time, not by the German and French workers, but by the capitalist class. I'll get my Marx quote in. He wrote, "The working class have no fatherland. So no frontier is worth the life of a single human being." Before I talk about the First World War, I just want to talk about war in the 19th century. I mean, before the 20th century, before the First World War. Wars were described as cabinet wars, i.e. they were small armies with a sort of a noble aristocratic officer corps, and all wars had sort of limited goals, and there was frequent changes of coalitions among belligerents. Wars were fought for limited ends and were settled relatively quickly. Colonial wars were generally limited wars of capitalist, imperialist expansion. Although the exception to this is the Napoleonic Wars, which was really the war of the bourgeois revolution, starting in France in 1789. That lasted on and off for 23 years, and it gave a slight foretaste of what war would be like in the 20th century. I mean, also the Crimean War, which took place in the 1850s. Now, it's described as like the first war of the modern capitalist era, but it was still a cabinet war. I.e., the British Army was still run by aristocratic elements and not by the bourgeoisie, and also had a limited strategic goals. Interestingly enough, the Italian War of Independence in 1859 ended after just two battles and just a few months of conflict. I mean, at the time, the casualty level amongst professional armies was deemed too high. At the Battle of Solferino in Italy, in a single day, about 40,000 soldiers on both sides died or were left wounded on the field. One man was so shocked by the terrible aftermath of the battle, he went on to establish the Red Cross. So, well, such limited wars ended with the onset of the imperialist phase of capitalist competition towards the end of the 19th century. Engels was really prophetic. In 1887, he wrote, "The only war left will be a world war. A world war, moreover, of an extent, the violence hitherto unimagined. 8 to 10 million soldiers will be at each other's throats, and in the process, they will strip Europe barer than a swarm of locusts. The depredations of the 30 Years' War, compressed into 3 or 4 years, and extended over the entire continent, famine, disease, the universal lapse into barbarism." That's a very good description of the First World War and the Second World War. So the 20th century opened, and I mean, the first Nobel Peace Prize was awarded in 1901. Killing civilians or non-combatants was outlawed by the Hague Conventions of 1899 and 1907. and that was signed by all the capitalist powers. But in World War One, the Hague Convention was in ruins. I mean, a third convention was actually planned for 1914. So let's talk about 1914 and the First World War. I mean, it's the first world imperialist war. I mean, we said in Socialist Party of Great Britain, and this holds true today, the capitalists have quarrelled over the question of the control of trade routes and the world's markets. I mean, the war was an annexationist, predatory, plunderous war. It was waged for the division of colonies and the robbery of foreign territory, a war for the division of the world. One of the reasons for Britain going to war was the defence of poor little Belgium, which is another capitalist lie. I mean, no mention was made on the Allied side of the atrocities in the Congo Free State, which had been privately controlled by the King of Belgium. Here, defenceless natives were maimed and slaughtered for profit when they failed to meet rubber collection quotas. Up to 8 million of the estimated 16 million native inhabitants died between 1885 and 1908. So Britain was going to war to defend a country with this sort of record. I mean, when the war came, its sheer destruction was not just the result of the new technology of warfare, but because all sides were determined to fight until the utter defeat and destruction of their opponents. I mean, the purpose of war is to defend every nation's capital value, but its function is to destroy economic value. Wars are no longer fought just by professional armies with little reference to the home front or the local economy. The war is an economic war. And as the economic stakes are enormous, the means used to fight wars know no restraint. I mean, we wrote in 1964 on the 50th anniversary of the start of the First World War, when war broke out in 1914, it was much vaster and grimmer than anything the Victorians had seen, something for which people were totally unprepared. Another capitalist lie about the First World War is that it was a war of democracy against militarism. But by 1916, Britain had become a major military state. There was conscription, direction of labour, direction of the economy, industry and labour, all in the service of the military machine. It was the end of the 19th century free trade and laissez-faire capitalism. I mean, up to about 1916, the war could have been described as a cabinet war. It was run by the departments of war. And the Liberal Asquith, the Prime Minister, had to resign, and Lloyd George became Prime Minister. The war also represents the death of liberal England, I mean, or the restriction on personal liberties, the end of the old Victorian liberalism. I mean, defence of the realm regulations restricted freedom of speech and assembly, and the Socialist Party came foul of these new regulations. AJP Taylor wrote something quite... I will quote it, I think it's quite good, actually. He's talking about the end of this liberal England, and he says, First World War, food was limited and its quality changed by government order. Freedom of movement was restricted, conditions of work prescribed, some industries were reduced or closed, others artificially fostered. The publication of news was fettered, street lights were dimmed, the sacred freedom of drinking was tampered with, licensed hours were cut down and the beer watered by order. The very time on the clocks was changed. From 1916 onwards, everybody got up an hour earlier in summer than they would otherwise have done, thanks to an Act of Parliament. The state established a hold over its citizens, which, though relaxed in peacetime, was never to be removed, and which the Second World War was again to increase. Well, the British government, the Labour Party, and all political parties, apart from the Socialist Party of Britain, urged the workers to support war in defence of democracy, parliamentary government and trade union rights, against so-called Prussian militarism and autocracy. I mean, German workers also were persuaded to defend their liberties against a barbarous, autocratic Russia to make the world safe for democracy. It was not a war for freedom or democracy. I mean, Tsarist Russia was actually only a couple of generations away from serfdom. Britain did not have universal suffrage. Germany, ironically, had universal male suffrage. But the British men in the trenches wouldn't have the same voting rights as the Germans across the no man's land. I mean, we said in 1914 that the pseudo-socialists and the labour leaders of this country betrayed the working class position, assisting the capitalist class in using this thieves' quarrel to confuse the minds of the workers and turn their attention from the class struggle. I mean, any government in capitalism has to defend the markets of its country's owning class, and that includes labour governments. I mean, this section I want to call, destruction of working class labour power. I mean, I think many people, I've got members of their family who would have served in the First World War, who probably were killed. I mean, I'll just give you a couple of examples from my family. My great-grandfather on my father's side was killed on the Western Front in 1918. And a great-uncle of mine on my mother's side, he died in 1936, aged 40. And that was from the effects of being gassed in the First World War. He was never well again. I mean, I'm sure people in the room can actually give similar stories as well. So this is just destruction of working-class labour power. These statistics are incredible. I will read them out. 65 million men mobilised for war. 10 million soldiers killed. 7 million civilians killed. 21 million wounded. 7 million permanently disabled. And I've got this figure here, 7 million missing. And following the war, there was an influenza epidemic throughout the world, and that killed about 10 million human beings. I mean, the Western Front, just to focus on that part of the war, became known as the sausage grinder, because it was fed with live soldiers, churned out corpses, and yet remained firmly in place. Also, there was something called Powell's battalions were actually organised in 1914. Because we're in Sussex, I'll talk about Sussex. In September 1914, three South Downs battalions of the Royal Sussex Regiment, known as Lowther's Lambs, were drawn from Sussex villages and towns of the South Downs. And these Powell's battalions, I mean, there was the Preston Powell's, there was the Grimsby Chums as well, but I'll just talk about the Sussex ones. I mean, they were destroyed at the Battle of the Somme in 1916. And the practice of drawing recruits from a particular region or a group meant that when a Powell's battalion suffered heavy casualties, the impact on individual towns and villages and neighbourhoods and communities was devastating. And conscription had to be introduced in 1916. And the working class of Germany, France and Britain had identical experiences in the trenches and no man's land. A great anti-war film is the 1930 German film All Quiet on the Western Front. I mean, in one scene in this film, a soldier suggests, instead of mass battles, he says, you should rope off a big field, and on the big day, you should take all the kings and their cabinets and their generals, put them in the centre, dressed in their underpants, and let them fight it out with clubs. The best country wins. This scene is mentioned in Robert Baltrop's book about the Socialist Party of Great Britain, and he writes about a packed screening of this film in an East London cinema in 1939, so just prior to the Second World War. And in that film, the suggestion that the ruling class themselves should fight was met by the audience with a spontaneous burst of cheering. The words express what everyone was feeling. I mean, throughout this scene, the clear message is that war is neither caused by, nor is it in the interests of the vast majority of people. And the enemy of the British working class soldiers was Field Marshal Haig. His contempt for the lives of the working class is evident in his diary entry, where he wrote, "Mostly gamekeepers and servants, after hearing that 13,000 men were killed in 3 hours, gaining 100 yards at the Battle of Passchendaele." It's interestingly enough, there are no veterans left of the First World War. Harry Patch, who was the last fighting Tommy of the First World War, he died in 2009 and he was aged 111 years. I mean, he fought and was wounded at Passchendaele. And he said, "War is a license to go out and murder for the British government. And that war isn't worth one life. It is the calculated and condoned slaughter of human beings." I just wish he was still alive. And he would. What would he be thinking about these commemorations? It would be interesting to see. I think Harry Patch actually just repeating what Rosa Luxemburg wrote. She wrote that war is methodical, organised, gigantic murder. And that the high state of world industrial development in capitalistic production finds expression in the extraordinary technical development and destructiveness of the instruments of war. In a way, the working class actually ended the First World War. I mean, there was mutinies in the French army in May to June 1917. Even the British army, there was a mutiny at Etaples in northern France in September 1917. And in Russia in 1917, the peasants and the proletarian soldiers just turned their backs on the front line and returned home, demanding bread, land and an end to the war. And then in Germany in October 1918, a naval mutiny spread to the army and workers in the cities and thus led to the armistice of November 1918. I mean, victory in the First World War left the British working class in a worse position than that of 1914. Lloyd George promised a land fit to heroes to live in, but the result was woefully inadequate for the working class. The capitalist class couldn't rely on volunteering of 1914 for the World War II. I mean, conscription was actually introduced in May 1939, prior to the outbreak of World War II. natural human aggression is frequently cited as a cause of war. Yeah, if it were, governments would not have to use conscription to push people into killing one another. I mean, we now have the United Nations. In the interwar period, we had the League of Nations. But we said, in the Socialist Party, the League of Nations or the United Nations cannot escape from the limitations imposed by capitalism. When major capitalist interests are involved, the powers cannot be prevented from using their armed forces to decide the vital issue of capitalist supremacy. I just think about the Iraq War of 2003. So when the rich wage war, the poor die. If the capitalist class wage war, the working class are killed. I mean, as socialists, we oppose capitalist wars. When capitalists wage war, the working class are killed, are maimed and wounded. As soldiers, but more likely today, to be civilians. Men, women and children. I mean, in Gaza this year alone, 513 children were killed. In fact, 44% of deaths in the Gaza offensive were children, women and elderly men. The capitalist class call this collateral damage. So war has behind it a highly developed large-scale industry. I mean, progress has brought civilian populations within easy reach of attack. I mean, so war actually attacks the working class on the home front and the destruction falls upon civilians. And this goes back to Cameron saying in his speech, he said, advances in technology transformed the nature of war. Indeed, they did. Even Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin in 1934 said, the bomber will always get through, i.e. aerial conflict. So I want to talk about the Second World War, which runs from the First World War. And this shows in the Second World War, it's the working class at home, not just necessarily soldiers, but the working class at home really felt the brunt of the war. Just for example, 500,000 civilian deaths in the Allied bombing of German cities in the Second World War. A 1941 British Air Staff paper said, the ultimate aim of an attack on a town area is to break the morale of the population which occupies it. To ensure this, we must achieve two things. First, we must make the town physically uninhabitable. And secondly, we must make the people conscious of constant personal danger. The immediate aim is therefore twofold. Namely, to produce one, destruction, and two, fear of death. Professor Lindemann was Churchill's scientific advisor, and he justified the use of bombing to dehouse the German worker. He was liked and trusted by Churchill, who appointed him to the cabinet in 1942. His dehousing paper was accepted by Churchill's cabinet, and Air Marshal Harris appointed to carry out the task. The aiming points will be the built-up areas, and not, for instance, the dockyards or aircraft factories. Bomber Harris, as he became known, said, the aim of the combined bomber offensive should be unambiguously stated as the destruction of German cities, the killing of German workers, and the disruption of civilised life throughout Germany, the destruction of houses, public utilities, transport and lives, the creation of a refugee problem on an unprecedented scale, and the breakdown of morale both at home and at the battlefronts by fear of extended and intensified bombing are accepted and intended aims of our bombing policy. They are not byproducts of attempts to hit factories. I mean, the firebombing of Japanese cities, for example, March 1945, 345 B-29 bombers attacked Tokyo. I mean, Tokyo at this stage was actually mainly a wooden city, and 15 square miles of it were actually burnt in 6 hours, leaving 168,000 people dead in a single night. This is still regarded as one of the single most barbarous acts of conventional bombing. I don't know if comrades have seen the documentary film The Fog of War, where Robert McNamara, who was Defence Secretary under Kennedy and Johnson in the 1960s, he was actually involved. He was a backroom boffing in the Second World War. And he talks about that firebombing of Tokyo, and he says General LeMay was focused on only one thing, target destruction. And he says, in that single night, we burned to death 100,000 Japanese civilians in Tokyo, men, women and children. 1 million sustained burns or injuries. I mean, the firebombing of Japanese cities is actually eclipsed by the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki later in the year. But actually, less people actually died at Nagasaki and Hiroshima than actually in the firebombing of Tokyo. I mean, McNamara says in the film that when LeMay served under him in the Kennedy administration, the old general commented that if Japan had won the war, they both would have been charged for acting like war criminals. I mean, war crimes are defined by whoever wins the war. I mean, again, there was the firebombing of Dresden in Germany in February 1945. Then World War II was already won, but it didn't stop the British and the Americans from firebombing Dresden. I mean, the figures for deaths in Dresden are, I haven't got an accurate figure because no one really knows. Because what happened was Dresden's normal population had been swelled by 400,000 refugees to something like 1 million, to a population of about 1 million people. I mean, this firebombing, the incendiaries actually created windstorms of over 100 miles an hour. So the fires became so large and they sought oxygen from all around. I mean, I've got to figure, the Allies said 35,000 died, but no, it's more likely 100,000. In the Second World War, the barbarism of war held no bounds. I mean, I've got to figure here, 24 million soldiers were killed, and a truly stunning 50 million civilian deaths, which I give a total of about 73 million human beings died in the Second World War. I mean, I mentioned Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, just quickly, Hiroshima, approximately 80,000 people were killed, and at Nagasaki, 74,000 people were killed. I mean, that was the culmination, really, of a war to the end. I mean, it's the logic of capitalist war. In 1949, General Curtis LeMay, who I spoke about in The Fog of War, he proposed that a total war in the nuclear age would consist of delivering the entire nuclear arsenal in a single, overwhelming blow, going so far as to kill a nation. A 1960 French journal called Programme Communiste, I want to quote from it, it's actually quite good about war. They wrote, "The goal of war is victory, and the destruction of enemy men and installations are only means for achieving this goal. Destruction is the principal goal of war. The imperialist rivalries that are the immediate cause of wars are themselves nothing but the consequence of over-increasing overproduction. Capitalist production is in fact forced to grow because of the fall in the profit level, and the crises are born of the need to ceaselessly expand production. War is the capitalist solution to the crisis. The massive destruction of installations, of the means of production and of goods, allows production to start up again, and the massive destruction of men cures the periodic overpopulation, which goes hand in hand with overproduction. And atrocities occurring within war occur not at a random moment, but in the middle of a crisis and an imperialist war. It is from thus, within this gigantic enterprise of destruction, that atrocities occur." So, in sort of conclusion, I mean, we said in 1914 that the facts point irresistibly to further great wars. And then we wrote again in 1919, "While competition between capitalist groups for routes, markets and control of raw materials exists, the cause of war remains." I mean, war is a symptom and result of capitalism. The only way to fight against war is to fight against the causes of war. The causes of war are part of the nature of capitalism. Paul Liebknecht wrote, "The main enemy of every people is in their own country. The main enemy is at home, the capitalist class." So the only way to fight against war is to fight against capitalism. The only possible struggle against the war is to fight for capitalism, fight for socialism. As socialists, We reaffirm that all peoples should seek their emancipation, not as members of nations or religions or ethnic groups, but as human beings, as members of the human family. We should unite to abolish the division of the world into so-called nation states. We said in 1914, "Having no quarrel with the working class of any country, we extend to our fellow workers of all lands the expression of our goodwill and socialist fraternity, and pledge ourselves to work for the overthrow of capitalism and the triumph of socialism." Socialism will mean the end of war. There will be no more trade routes, markets, property or profit to fight over. If everyone owns everything, or to put it another way, if nobody owns anything, then there's nothing to fight over. With production for use to meet human needs, the era of real peace will have arrived.
Thank you very much.